I'm Jonathan Green. You're listening to Lost and Found, and this week the adventure continues. Bookshops around the world, part two. You had a telephone like my jets. We've done Paris, we've done London, we've even been to the Welsh market town of Hay-on-Wye. Now, we find ourselves in the Dutch city of Maastricht. There's a girl on my mind that she knows I'm thinking of her. Now, this place has an incredibly long history. Going back to medieval times, I'm standing outside a church that was built in the 13th century, which functioned as part of a monastery. After the French Revolution, it was seized and used as a warehouse. In the early 19th century, the building was given to the city of Maastricht, and it was used as an exhibition centre, a concert hall, and now, you guessed it, a bookshop.
It's built in a simple Gothic style.
Rob Browers, architect of Satin Plus, has led the restoration and transformation of the building into a place for bibliophiles.
You cannot compare it with one of the cathedrals in France, as you have. You have also a lot of Gothic cathedrals. But it's a simple church, and it has one nave and two aisles to the left and to the right. Mm-hmm. And it's built in a simple Gothic style. And the material it's built of is also very special in the Netherlands, because we have no natural stone in the Netherlands. We have only sand and clay in the ground. But we have in Maastricht also one mountain, and we call it the St. Peter's Mountain, and that's built up of marl stone. A marl stone is a very soft stone. You can compare it a little bit with the White Cliffs of Dover, but it's yellow.
Yep.
It's very soft. Yeah, you can easily carve it also. It was very appropriate to make Gothic forms of that. Mm. And so you see a yellow church, and it becomes from the outside always a little bit gray, and that's yellow. And inside, and you see simple Gothic vaults, and you have a lot of columns, etc. And it's very only long church. And it was the church of a monastery, but the monastery has gone. It was taken down in the 19th century. And today, this church stands along a new shopping center.
So the decision to make this into a book-selling space, into a bookshop, how did that come
about?
So
we had no quarrel or any discussion with religious people, with priests or other men, because it was already 200 years out of the religious function. And the city wanted to make it part of the new shopping center next door. But because it was a big room within the city, government wanted also to keep the same building to can be used as a, let's say, little cultural building with the cultural functions. So that even when the bookshop was there, they have, and it's still today, they have to give room for small concerts, for poetry, for little expositions, etc., etc.
Perfect.
And that makes it also to a modern bookshop.
Yes, indeed. That is so important in so many book spaces. Really? When you first walked in there to begin this process, what did you find? Had the years been kind to this building?
But you see just the nave and the two aisles, and it's very open, very high. And you have two special sites in that. We have on the wall one of the oldest mural paintings in Western Europe. It's from 14th century, and that is a wall painting made by the monks in that time. And it shows the life of Thomas from Aquino.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the members of the Dominican order. And you see it at the walls, you see, and we restored them, and that's the only remains we have from vault painting. And you see Baroque paintings, and that belongs to a restyling of the church in the 17th and 18th century. And these are the only things that remains you to a church. Otherwise, only the architecture and the space inside. And so this open. And everybody in Maastricht knows this and had used this this church as a public space, a covered public space, you can say that, in the last century. And so And then the plan started to bring in this bookshop. We all, also the interior architects of the bookshop, the booksellers who wanted to install this bookshop in the church, we wanted to do it in a way that you can always feel and see that it is a church. So we didn't bring in new floors or new ceilings. We left the room as it was, so you can always see and feel how it is and that it is a church. And so the only thing we brought in were bookshelves to the walls. But in the middle of the church, we built in the book flat, that is to say, it's a building with several rooms or houses stacked on each other. And so we built in a steel building in the nave, but it's only to one side of the nave. So we introduced an axe. Everything to the left of that axe remained open. To the right, we brought in these three-story high bookshelves. So you can walk in, you can take a small elevator, you can go by staircases, and you find three levels of bookshops, and you walk on a kind of a gallery along this. You can compare a little bit with a library. High libraries, and only to one part, and it's free. It's built up free in the room, so you can always see and feel, and it's a very nice experience when you want to go in to go high up in this these bookshelves. You do that at the inner side. And when you are on your level, you go outside and you walk on the galleries before the bookshelves.
And the galleries too, with shelves about them. But never, from what I've seen of the building, never do you lose the sense of scale of the church that surrounds it. It is still impressive.
Yes, you are right. So what we... You can say... Well, we made a little icon of that. Everybody knows the portrait Andy Warhol made of Marilyn Monroe, and you can imagine that. And when you cover that for half, you always see and remember, and you make it complete in your mind. So and you go, oh yes, that must be Marilyn Monroe, and so that's what we did in the church also. And we covered one part. And because these churches are always symmetrical, that you always make it completely. And that's a very nice experience. And we were all very proud of founding that. Said, so you could use the building, you could fill it a little bit up, but you always keep...
Always, it was still there, yes. Completed in your mind. What was the public reaction, Rob, when the building was reopened in this new use?
Everybody was at the same time very enthusiastic about the new function and the way we did it. And the church is still there as the people remembered it before. So it was not a church. It was always an open space. And we kept it open. Also, we brought in so many thousands of books. And it became so famous that you know it in Australia.
So, after an appropriate number of laps of the bookshop's Dominican and after picking up and putting down numerous volumes, but keeping the ones we like on hand, and possibly after a coffee and a wander around this historic city, I think we should move on. And via the magic of radio and a click of the fingers, we're in Chandigarh, India. And who better to be our guide than Jasmeet Kosahi, who has taken me to the English bookshop. How curious. We seem to have landed in front of the English bookshop, but we are not in England. Where are we?
We're certainly not in England. Well, it's a bookshop in my hometown, Chandigarh, which is the capital city of Punjab and Haryana, actually.
Jasmeet Kosahi, a Melbourne-based writer, editor and arts worker. In 2017, she, along with the team of the Melbourne Writers Festival, brought India's biggest literary festival, the Jaipur Literary Festival, to Melbourne.
And interestingly, I don't know the real story, but I can make an educated guess of why it's called the English Bookshop. It's because India has over 22 scheduled languages, and over 100 are spoken in homes across the country. So I think it's probably a way of separating and indicating that this is a bookshop which might have English language books. Now, although it's different, it has quite a few languages, but I think that might be the case of why it's called the English bookshop.
Shall we go in and tell us what we see?
Yes, absolutely. So before we go into the English bookshop, I think you have to first stand outside it and really appreciate where you're standing, which is Sector 17. And for people who have been to Chandigarh or have passed through as tourists or as students of architecture or law or in general, going all their way to Kasol and Shimla in the mountains, would really know what I mean when Sector 17 is this plaza, this beautiful concrete flat plaza of shops and movie theaters and people sitting around with, you know, trees enclosed in concrete benches and lots of sunglasses, as they're called, cool glasses in India sometimes, being sold. And you're standing outside, and all of this is something that you take in, and then you walk into the shop, and of course you're greeted by rows and rows and rows of books. But unlike my experience here in Australia, in Melbourne, especially with bookshops, it's a slightly different experience in India, in Chandigarh. You might walk in, and just before you enter the shop, there might be somebody who might be sitting with their wares, you know, on the floor with books which are photocopied or Xeroxed, as we say, and being sold right outside a bookshop. So that's also an experience that you might encounter. Hmm.
Do you remember the last time you were there, and perhaps the last book that you bought from the English bookshop?
I actually have a very special memory that I have of that particular place. And it was really surprising when I was contacted to talk about this, because I was in India almost 2.5 years ago. I was there to get married. And I had a friend who was visiting from another place where I did my college from. So we were college friends, and she was visiting me because she was, you know, part of the wedding celebrations. And all of us, including my parents, my brother, his wife, all of us were in Sector 17, as you do when you are in Chandigarh. And of course, we had to go to the English bookshop. And so that memory is really important for me, because we took a picture outside. I look at that picture many times, because it's one of the last times that I was with family, my immediate family. And so, yeah, I went in. I think I bought Rupa Bajwa's The Sari Shop with, I think, 8 or 9 other books. I'm pretty sure. I haven't read all of them, but I do remember buying Rupa Bajwa's The Sari Shop, definitely. That's one of my memories of that place.
Talk to us more about Chandigarh. And is it a city of readers? Is it a big literary city?
I'd like to imagine so, because it's a hugely historical city. It is one of India's probably only few planned cities. And by planned, I mean there was a real national vision behind creating a city like Chandigarh. And when people say history, of course, they might also go back really back in time. But I think there is something special about the contemporary history of Chandigarh, its creation, its vision, and then also the frustrations, I'm sure, that Mr. Le Corbusier must have felt with his team working with the architects in the 50s, and how they wanted to incorporate their own visions into creating a city for Indian people. I digress, sorry.
Well, no, but let us go to Le Corbusier and his presence in this place. Tell us that story.
His presence is large and yet small. I don't really know how else to describe it. My first, I guess, comprehension of the city was, why is it so concretized? And I never used the word concrete. I would say cement. That's how, you know, that's the word I would have used, I'm sure. So much cement. The buildings are, you know, even a hotel, like a 5-star hotel is also, there's no color. There's no jazz about the buildings. The buildings are plain and bland. The insides are, of course, opulent and beautiful. So that was my first thoughts about the city. And also, it's a grid. you have four ways of getting to any place. You will rarely get lost because if you are literate in numbers, if you know you're at one, next comes two, three, four. So it's divided into sectors. And I guess that goes back to Le Corbusier and the architects who work with him and their plan for the city, which was about, you know, communicating a vision of modernity and really looking at splitting the life of people in an orderly fashion. I guess it might have come from the desire to have people have comfort in moving within their life and knowing where to find things in an almost organic fashion if you lived in the city. That's my thinking. But there is a lot, as I have discovered, a lot went on in the creation of the city because it was right after the partition of mm-hmm. India, which was a gift the British left us with, unfortunately. The Prime Minister at the time, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, who was keen on creating, like I said, like a vision of a modern India. So there are problems with that, I'm sure. But I guess at the time it was a real challenge and an opportunity for people to come together and create, I would like to call it a historical city.
The Corbusier master plan, as much as you mentioned so much concrete, it also gives a lot of space to green space. The green space is very important in the plan of Chandigarh.
Yes, 100%. It's also often been called the garden city. So like I said, it's like a grid. So small square sectors, each divided into A, B, C, D. So each of the sectors are separated by this green strip. And in the middle is what we call, I don't know if you understand the word roundabout, but that was a really common, a very common word growing up, the roundabout, or sector 9 roundabout, or sector 10 roundabout. So one is called Matka Chonk. So Chonk is the word where four roads come together in Punjabi and Hindi. And it would always be green and beautiful and flowers and or some sculpture would be part of it. Because, you know, Chandigarh also is known for its architecture and students come from all over the world to study architecture there. And of course, we have the Zakir Hussain Rose Garden, the biggest rose garden in Asia, over, I think, over 30 or 50 acres.
My goodness, if there isn't a better place to sit in the sun and read a book, I haven't heard of it. But when you finish that chapter, I'm going to have to ask you to pack up, get ready again. We have one last destination. And Juliana will be meeting us there.
New York, I don't know if you've ever lived there, Jonathan, can be a very lonely, alien sort of place because New Yorkers keep to themselves.
Juliana Engberg, curator and author of En Route.
But they are tremendous bibliophiles. They do love a bookshop. And where I lived, which was down in Greenwich Village, there were two places that I particularly gravitated to. There were Three Lives, which was on the corner of Bleecker and 10, or was it 4? I don't know. There's a little confluence of streets there. But Three Lives was a lovely bookshop, and it reminded me a little bit of Hatchard's, I suppose. It had that old worldy feel, but it wasn't, I think, actually all that old particularly. But it had a great biography section, and it was just around the corner from a cafe called The Black Sheep, which was quite appealing to me because it sounded like outsiders. And you used to go and browse, you know, buy a book, go to the cafe, or go to Dante Cafe. That was also very nice. And the other bookshop that I loved very much in New York was the Strand Books, of course, which is, you know, somewhat legendary, you know, with 10,000 miles of books or something, they say. I think actually it was recently under threat of closure because of the COVID pandemic, but all of its followers and supporters and customers sent in orders straight away, and I think they made something like $200,000 American in one day. Good on them. There's fraternity. There's community. So they saved the Strand Bookshop. To me, it was always a bit daunting, though, I have to be honest, but it was appealing because it had second-hand books.
Why daunting?
Well, you know, if you have Shakespeare & Co., which is dinky and small and boutique, you have, you know, Strand Books, which is more like your liner. You know, it's bigger and brasher and better in America. And so, you know, they made the biggest bookshop on earth. Of course they did. You know, and I suppose in some ways it sets the model for those mega stores that then come to swallow up all sorts of play. I mean, to my great despair, I have to admit, Hatchards has been, you know, gobbled up into the Watersons chain. It hasn't changed the shop, but it's sad to think that, you know, those independent booksellers who really started things with passion and, you know, as I say, that kind of utopian thought are not really surviving. It's tough out there. The other shop in New York that I liked very much was a very specialty kind of shop was Printed Matter. And it reminded me a lot of the Source Book Shop in Melbourne, which was near the In Shoppy, just off Collins Street, where in the 70s you could buy all of these amazing little artist books by people like Ed Ruscha, and you could dip into poetry and mysticism and stuff like that. Printed Matter is very much related to, devoted to the publishing of artist limited edition books and things of this sort. So it's very much a go-to place. If you're ever in New York and you want to kind of get something that is a little bit collectible and very special and a very limited edition, Printed Matter is the place to go, because they still produce fantastic artist runs. And, you know, who knows, you might be sitting there with something a little bit later that is highly valuable. I wish I'd bought the Ed Ruscha's at the Source Bookshop when I had the chance, I must say.
Do you have, on visiting a bookshop in a new city, do you have a pattern of behaviour? Is there a way in which you approach that space?
You mean do I scope it out first? Do I sneak in and then sneak? Well, look, to be absolutely truthful, sometimes places that have great iconic status can be a little daunting. And if you're a very scruffy traveller, as I was when I was young, it did take a little courage to sort of get in the door, because you thought that you would be, you know, found out. You're not going to buy anything. You're just there to browse. But these days I have no issue with these sorts of things, and I don't think it would have mattered anyway. I think in the main, bookshops have realised that they're not just sellers. They're creators of something that's quite unique. And that is a sense of belonging. And that's especially true if you're a person on the road. I think that's especially true in your local area too. And, you know, hands up and, you know, thumbs up, punch out, sound out, shout out to all of the, you know, small book traders who keep providing that kind of environment. I mean, how important is it, and how important do we know it is now when we've been distance from our community? These little places are like oases that, you know, really nurture one and give you great solace, I think. So, you know, unlike a library, which is about sort of researching and things, I don't know, bookshops are about also nodding at that person just along the line there who's also looking at biographies or looking at history and kind of going, yeah, we're here again. We don't know each other, and it's fine, and we never probably will. But I guess there's a reason, Jonathan, why they always have, you know, little scenes in bookshops in a lot of those movies that are going to talk. You know, I think it's called the meet cute. How many meet cutes are established in bookshops? I think, you know, the romantic in this hopes to think that, you know, one spine leads to another.
Juliana, on that note, thank you so much.
Sail well and read on.
You've been listening to Lost and Found. This week, Bookshops Around the World, Part 2. You heard from Rob Browers, Jasmit Korsahi and Juliana Engberg. For more literary travel, find Lost and Found episodes on Rome in poetry, Bergen, Galway. Or, yes, listen back to Bookshops Around the World, Part 1. While you're at it, why not tune into the book show or the bookshelf on RN? You can follow all of that on the ABC Listen app or your favourite podcast venue. Producers are Lisa DeVisi and Alan Whedon. Technical production by Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green.